Processing ready access. Please enter your 7-digit. Thank you. Please stand by. You will now be placed into conference.
Your type.
Okay.
Because
there was some prompting when I logged in to record it myself. Is that right?
Do you know, Lauren, do you know about that?
As a presenter, it'll ask you to record, but I've taken care of the recording, so you
make it. Okay. Yeah, I just canceled out of it. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's recording now. You can see the counter up top.
Ah, okay. Great.
Hello, everyone. This is Matt Menny from NOAA NCDC.
Hi. Hi, Matt. This is Eva. We're just waiting for people to call in. And actually, I don't know. I'll walk through the logistics of the of how live meeting works, but you could actually see who calls in.
Okay, yeah, it's coming up on my screen.
Yeah, so you could see the attendees, which is nice.
Hi, folks. It's Eva, and I just thought we'd give people maybe 2 more minutes to call in. So just hang in there, please.
Okay. Reasonable request.
Okay, well, I have 2:01 on my watch, so I guess we could get started. This is
I'm Eva Wong. I'm at the EPA running the Urban Heat Island program here, and I want to welcome you to our second webcast. Before we were having national conference calls, but now we've started this webcast format. And just to remind you about the agenda for the call, I'm just going to spend a few minutes walking through the logistics of the webcast live meeting software, how it works, because I'm sure we have a couple new people who haven't used live meeting before. Then we're going to hand it over to Dr. Brian Stone, followed by Drew Crawley, and then Sarah Espinosa is going to wrap it up in terms of formal presentations with slides. Then I hope, you know, if there's remaining time, we could kind of just go around and give each other updates on the work that we're doing, because I always think it's nice when we have so many, you know, experts and people of related interests on the line to just use this as an opportunity to talk. So moving on to my next slide, please, during the presentations, if you could mute your phones by either using your own mute button or by pressing star 6, that would be great, because there's so much background noise, it's really disruptive. So please do mute your phone, star 6, or use your own mute button. And when you want to speak, which will allow time for Q&A after each presentation, if you could press star 7 or just unmute your mute button on your phone. If you want to see the full screen and not see all the different, you know, pop-up or drop-down boxes, you can press F5 to show the presentation full screen. And then to go back to the live meeting console, you press F5 again. As I was noting, you'll have an opportunity to ask questions after each speaker. You can just unmute your phone and, you know, ask the question. Or if you want, you can actually use this feedback drop-down menu, which we're going to talk about in the next slide. If you're interested in seeing who's participating in the webcast, there's an opportunity to view the attendee list, and maybe many of you already have that open on your computers. During the webcast, if you're having problems, or I know a couple people were saying they couldn't access the webcast feature because they had Macintosh computers or whatever, Nikhil Nadkarni at that email address or telephone number can help you out. So she can send you the PowerPoints if you need them, or do what you need, or help you out with any kind of technical difficulties. Now in terms of view and layout, this is hopefully what you see on your screen. And again, as I was saying, say press F5 to see the full screen and F5 to return to the live meeting console. And to restore all defaults, if something happens or you don't know what happened, go to the view, I don't know what it's called, drop-down feature, and select Restore Default Layout from that drop-down menu under View, and that'll restore everything to its old settings. Next, for feedback and questions, as I was saying, you can just ask them, or you can try to use the feedback or question box feature. So you can either just change your color. Right now, everyone's on green, which is saying things are going fine. You don't need the presenter to slow down, or you know, everything's at the right pace. You can change your color. There's a drop-down menu that says Feedback to Presenter. You can change that to purple if you have a question, or if you need the presenter to slow down, you know, change your color to red. So here that circles that feature. If you want to just narratively ask your question, you can type it into that box that's circled in that long, the example circled in the long oblong circle, red circle. So you just type in your question and then you press ask. So that's the other. And then lastly, as I was saying, you could view who's attending, participating on the call, which I always like to do to see who's called in. You just click on the attendees drop-down menu and you should see that. So those are basically the logistics. I hope that that's all clear. Next, we're going to hand it over to Dr. Brian Stone. Brian, are you able to click onto your presentation now? Do you have that?
Yeah. You want me to do that?
Sure.
There
that
go.
Would be great.
Okay. And should I lock myself?
Yes, wanted
yes.
to do that. So
okay, I'm locked in. I'm in control.
That's great. just to review, Dr. Brian Stone, he's an assistant professor in the City and Regional Planning Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and we're very glad to have him here. So Brian, please go ahead.
Okay, Eva, thanks. I'm thrilled to be with you in the comfort of my office, all of you. I am a bit of a novice at the webcast, which is amazing technology. I will look for purple boxes. I can't promise I'll see you, so I'm happy for you to just interject if you have a question and answer it while I'm going. I'll answer it when we get to the end to the Q&A, but I will look to see if any purple boxes come up. I'm going to be talking today about some recent research that is focused on the rate at which urban areas are warming and whether this rate or whether urban areas in general are serving to amplify background rates of warming that we might associate with the global greenhouse effect. I'm going to focus on four general topics today. I'm going to talk about mechanisms of climate change just briefly. My sense is that most, if not all of you, are familiar with the global greenhouse effect and how that differs from the urban heat island effect, but I know we have a range of background. So I'm just going to touch on that and highlight one point I want to make. And then talk about how I've measured what I'm calling urban warming trends in this study, and then present the results and talk again just briefly about what are potential planning implications of these findings. Starting with this slide number 3, this is the annual temperature anomaly data that's reported by NASA every year. And this is probably the most widely recognized evidence of global warming that people see when NASA comes out and they say 2005 was the hottest year on record, or 2007 was one of the top 10. And this is essentially the data set they're working from. This is just the U.S. Data, but they also have a global data set. And so I want to talk about in some of my time how they are deriving this information and whether this trend we see when we see this kind of rapid increase in temperature starting in the late 1970s, whether this is capturing well what's happening in large U.S. cities or whether the urban trends might differ from this somewhat. Click down here. I wanted to start with this slide on the greenhouse effect just to highlight one significant point here, and that when we think about the phenomenon of global warming, it's actually a product of two distinct physical phenomena. One is what we most commonly talk about, and that's the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and what is happening with the trapping of outgoing long-wave radiation. We have the incoming short-wave radiation from the sun, which passes through the greenhouse gases. They're transparent to the radiation. But then the long-wave radiation that's being emitted from the Earth's surface, of course, is being trapped and readmitted and creating this warming effect. We can think of that as the atmospheric warming mechanism. There's a secondary mechanism that's happening here, and this graphic captures it with this horizontal arrow across the land surface of Europe in this case. And that is that we're modifying the surface characteristics of the planet as well, and that's also contributing to warming. So deforestation, that's making way for either agriculture or urbanization and things of that nature, are actually increasing surface temperatures as well. And so where we'd have an accumulation of greenhouse gases with no land surface changes, we would expect to see theoretically some rise in temperature. But also, if we were to see land surface changes that were increasing surface temperature without any accumulation of greenhouse gases, we would also expect to see some warming. And so both of these are independent, and they're not always emphasized in the research. And this next slide is just illustrative of these various changes. Deforestation in the Amazonian basin, for example, is driving an increase in surface temperatures, and so is urbanization. There's been little attention, or not a great number of studies that have sought to tease out these two phenomena, which is contributing more to the rise in temperature that we see in near surface or near surface air temperatures. This is one study that was published in Nature several years ago now that used an industry methodology. In this case, they're using weather balloons essentially to measure upper atmospheric temperature measurements. And they're comparing that to near surface land measurements, and they're teasing out the contribution of land surface change. And in this case, most of the weather stations that are there in the eastern half of the U.S. But what they found is that about 50% of the rise in near-surface air temperatures since the 1960s is attributable to land surface change. And that's a very important finding, if accurate. There are some important critiques of this study, and there are not many to back it up. But it raises the question of how significant is land surface change to the temperature changes we're seeing. So in this study, I'm asking a somewhat similar question, and that is, if we look at temperature change in large cities, there are two components. One is the urban heat island effect, which is driven in large part by land surface changes, and the other is the global greenhouse effect. Both of those are theoretically contributing to temperature change in cities, and which is more significant. And so I'm essentially trying to measure how much or to what degree urbanization is amplifying background rates of warming. To do that, I draw on a data set that was developed by NASA. It's the same data set they used to create the temperature trend data that I started with. And their data set is drawn from a very large global network of both sea and land meteorological stations, known as the Global Historical Climatology Network. And so what I'm using is a subset of these meteorological stations, and I'm looking at data from the 1950s to 2000. Now, to do that, to measure temperature over 50 years requires very high quality data. And so in terms of the U.S. stations, what we draw on are known as first order weather stations. And these are weather stations where the staff has been certified by the National Weather Service and the instrumentation is periodically validated. In particular, in this data set that NASA's developed, four sources of bias or inhomogeneity is the technical term, but essentially they're just correcting for bias, have been addressed in the data. And there are four things. If we think about measuring temperature over 50 years, there are lots of external changes that could create a bias in the temperature record. For example, you could physically move the weather station. You could move the thermometer. And if you were to change the microclimate or the elevation, that would create a shift in the long-term temperature record that would be attributable to something other than climate. And so it's important to have data where that source of bias has been corrected for. Change in instrumentation. We know that weather instrumentation has become more precise over time, and so that can create a shift in the long-term temperature trend. Change in the time of observation, when you're measuring temperature over what averaging time needs to be accounted for. And then this final one, contamination by urbanization. And contamination is the technical term. And this is describing the bias that's a product of the urban heat effect. And so, and this is a particularly important point for this study, in that the data sets that have been used to study global and national temperature trends are actually either removing urban meteorological stations from the data set, or they're statistically adjusting them to remove the influence of the urban heat effect. Now, there are two reasons to do that, at least two, that are significant. If you are interested in measuring the phenomena of atmospheric warming, if you're interested in measuring the contribution of the accumulation of greenhouse gases to warming over time, then you want to correct for the land surface changes that are also driving temperature change. And so it makes sense to adjust your temperature observations in the places that are experiencing the most significant changes in terms of land surface. And then secondly, if you're interested in measuring average warming globally, if you want to get a sense of how much is temperature changing in an average location on the planet's surface, well, urban areas are not an average location. They are a rather anomalous location. Urban areas still account for a very small percentage of the total land surface. And so if you're interested in average temperature change, the urban measurements will serve as outliers, and they will bias your measurements. So it's possible to get these data from NASA with both the correction for urbanization and without. And so what I'm doing is I am acquiring the data for urban weather stations that has not been corrected to get a sense of whether the trends in cities are different than the trends in rural areas. Forgive me, I went back a few slides. Okay, so in this study I've identified 50 large cities. These are 50 of the 60 largest metropolitan areas in the U.S. And you may note on this slide that there are some important cities that are missing Chicago is missing, San Francisco is missing. These are cities that, of course, are among the 50 most populous, but for which we do not have a consistent temperature record that's been corrected back to 1950. And so in the case of Chicago, there actually is not a single data set that goes back to 1950 that I could use, so I had to eliminate it. So what I end up with are 50 of the 60 most populous. These are the cities or the regions for which we have this long-term temperature record. This next slide, number 10, is what the raw data actually looks like. This is data from the Atlanta station, the Hartsfield-Jackson Airport observations. And this shows a trend that's consistent with, at least in form rather than actual magnitude, that is similar to most of the weather stations that we see. And that's that we see a general increase throughout the early half, or the first half of the 20th century, and then a rather significant reduction in temperature in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and then we start to increase again in the 80s and 90s. And there's a specific climatological phenomena that's driving that dip that I'll talk about in just a minute, but I just want to give you a sense of this is what the raw data looks like. And I'm acquiring this for a single urban weather station and three rural weather stations that are in proximity to each city. So the station selection criteria are important. And I start off with first just trying to distinguish between what is urban and what is rural. And a very useful piece of data to do that is the surface luminescence that's captured by a military satellite. And this is what you probably all seen this image is what the U.S. looks like at night from space. And so NASA has gone through and ranked every weather station as far as whether it is bright, dim, or dark. So dark receives an A, dim a B, and bright a C. And so weather stations that are in urban areas are those that have a night-like ranking of C. And in this case, I had very few options. If you look at the corrected data for major cities, there's usually only one and sometimes just two weather stations that have been corrected. And in almost all cases, this is the airport. And so for these urban stations, I'm using the airport meteorological station, which creates its own significant biases and limitations that I'll talk about over the next few slides. And of course, only using a single weather station to represent an entire metro area is also very problematic. But it's the data that's available back in 1950, but we need to consider that when we evaluate the results here. The rural stations are selected based on three criteria, nightlight ranking of A, dark in most cases, or B, dim if a dark station was not available, low population densities, less than 4,000 per square kilometer, and then located within 50 to 250 kilometers of the urban weather station. Let's look at an example of the airport data in the case of Atlanta. This again is Hartsfield-Jackson, Atlanta's airport. And this is characteristic of almost all the airport, in fact, all the ones that I've looked at in this case, is that the weather station is upwind of the airport. And so the objective in positioning this is to capture incoming weather, to measure incoming weather over the field that gives you, obviously, useful information about landing planes and managing the airport. In terms of the immediate surroundings, in this case, it's not in the middle of the tarmac, obviously, or on top of a building. The immediate surroundings, in this case, are a green field about 100 yards off of the runways. And so this is going to be influenced both by its immediate climate and the larger climate in which it is located. If we look at the region, the airport is south of the city. And so the question, of course, that becomes important is this a good surrogate for Atlanta? If you only have a single meteorological station, is the airport a good surrogate? In one sense, it's not, in that it's not right downtown in the central business district. And so it's not going to be capturing temperatures that are consistent with that. But if we think about the actual land cover materials, they're largely consistent with what we would see. We see lots of impervious cover, very few trees, consistent with what we might see downtown. The best test, of course, is to look at the actual surface temperature data, and we can do that with data NASA recorded in the late 1990s. CBD is the central business district of Atlanta, the downtown district. And if we look at surface temperature and compare that to around the airport, you see some of the runways, the Hartsfield-Jackson image and some of the administrative buildings and terminals. What we see is in general, the central business district in terms of just surface temperatures is higher. On average, you're seeing higher surface temperatures. And so in this one case, and this is one out of 50, but I think it's largely consistent with what we see in all these cases, is that the airports are generally, in terms of just surface temperature, underestimating what we would see downtown. And so in that sense, the results of the study may be somewhat conservative, but you have to look at this in terms of each actual metropolitan area. So it's important to consider. I just want to spend a few slides on that. So I'll move on to the results. I have a few slides of these national maps, and I want to help you decipher this. It's a lot of data to digest in a single slide or a few slides. This is measuring the urban trend. So this is the temperature change measured on the level of the decade for these 50 urban airports, the urban weather station. And what this is showing is that averaged over the five decades, the average change in temperature was about 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. So over the 50 years, about 1 degree Celsius temperature change had increased on average for these cities. Now, of course, there was variation. For most of the cities, we saw an increase in temperature during this time on average. For some, we saw a decrease. We see this in a number of cities up in the Northeast, Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Pittsburgh, for example. What this means is not that these cities necessarily have been cooling off or cooling off in the last 20 years. What it does mean is that what we've seen during this period of time from 1951 to 2000 are trends in which we saw temperatures increasing, periods in which we saw temperatures decreasing. And for these cities, the cooling trends are the dominant trend. And so a good example of this is Pittsburgh, to look at the raw data again, which we see here. We see this characteristic dip in temperature during the 50s and 60s and throughout most of the 70s and an increase. What we're looking at in terms of these red and blue dots is the average temperature pattern from 1950 to 2000. In the case of Pittsburgh, you had both cooling and warming, but you had more cooling than warming. And so we end up with, on average, a blue dot, which is indicative of a predominance of cooling. Now, why are we seeing this dip? We see this in all the data sets. There are potentially a number of reasons, but the most likely is an association with the phenomenon in the Pacific known as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. This is essentially a long-term El Nino, El Niña phase. It happens on the course of decades rather than on the course of just a few years or months. It's reflective of changes in sea surface temperatures. It's a long-term oscillation, and it has significant and measurable implications for weather throughout the continental U.S. And other parts of the globe. And so what we see here is in the 50s and 60s and 70s, largely a negative phase. And this contributed to, in some part, this dip in temperature that we see in Pittsburgh that was particularly pronounced in a place like Pittsburgh. And so why it was more pronounced in Pittsburgh than perhaps some of these urban weather stations, I would not pretend to be qualified to say. I'm not sure that the science is sufficient today to tell us that, but there are potentially a number of reasons. But in general, what we see is this dip in the decades of the 50s, 60s, and 70s that is most probably correlated with the PDO. I mean, it's definitely correlated, but driven by it. And that's having a more pronounced influence in some places than others. So that gives you some bit of a sense of understanding the red and the blue and the trends. The rural trends, the slide I have up now, is showing, again, in most of the rural weather stations, and these are these three weather stations in proximity to each urban area that have been averaged, we see, in most cases, a predominance of warming over cooling. The average rate of warming over all these cities was 0.15 degrees Celsius, so a little bit lower than we saw in the urban stations. And then somewhat of a shift, we have a number of stations in the southeast or the southern latitudes of the country where we're seeing more cooling than warming in the rural stations. And so the objective here is to subtract the rural trend from the urban trend. and that's what we see here. And on average, we get a mean decadal change in the urban heat island of 0.05 degrees Celsius. And we'll talk in a minute about providing some context for that number. But what this shows is, again, on average, we're seeing an increase in the intensity of heat islands over time. Now, the blue that we see here, the blue circles, are not indicative of places that no longer have heat islands. They are indicative of places where you're seeing a convergence between rural and urban temperatures. And I want to give you an example because I know the data can be somewhat confusing if you're not used to looking at these types of studies. But let's take Philadelphia, which has been in the news a lot lately, not for climatological reasons. But we can see Philadelphia in terms of the urban trend in this slide, and we see a medium to small size red circle suggesting that the urban weather station has been warming. There's been a predominance of warming during this 50-year period. If we look at the rural trend, it's a red circle that's a little larger. And so what we're seeing is that both the urban weather station and the rural weather stations are increasing temperature over time, but that the rural weather stations are increasing temperature more rapidly. Now that's interesting, and it raises lots of questions about why that might be the case. We see significant clusters on this slide in terms of the UHI trends, where we see in the Northeast this cluster of places where we have a convergence between rural and urban temperatures, where heat islands are diminishing over time. And we see just the opposite in the southern latitudes in the southeast and into the southwest. Now, I can only posit as to why that might be the case. There are competing theories, and every conference I go to, I get a new one that's also compelling. But I'll tell you, the one predominant trend that I see is that these cities in the Northeast have been losing population for the most part from 1950 to 2000. Certainly not growing as rapidly as we see in the Southeast or in the Sun Belt cities, and in many cases actually losing population. What that may mean, and again, this is speculative because I don't have the data to tell me definitively, but it may mean that we're seeing somewhat of a regeneration of vegetation within the urban areas. And that could mean that they are warming less rapidly than they might have historically, and that they are diminishing their rate of warming while the rural areas are warming at a constant rate. And that could lead to more of a diminishment of the heat island. There could be other drivers here. In many of these cities, we have old coal-fired power plants that are right downtown. This could be increasing aerosols and creating a localized cooling effect. Again, I can't tell you exactly what's driving this phenomenon. I can't tell you that there's a statistical difference between these two areas that's interesting. It's somewhat of a secondary question for this study, but it's definitely worth highlighting and raising that question because I know we have lots of expertise on this call, so maybe others will have greater insights than I do into that. To provide some context for what I found overall, this chart is showing estimates or measurements of temperature change at different scales during this same period, 1951 to 2000, at the global level. And this is reporting temperature change in degrees Celsius per century, so I changed the unit on you and moved that decimal place. Don't be confused by that. But the globe during this period of time increased by about a degree Celsius. The U.S. increased by a little bit more than that, 1.7 degrees Celsius. And then what you see in the next two bars, the rural and urban, are the data that I just reported, which is showing from the rural weather stations, which is a subset of the stations used to produce the U.S. number, about 1.5 degrees during this period of time per century. And I want that number, I'm hoping that number will be close to the U.S. number because it's a subset of that same data set, and it's reasonably close. And then the urban number here from my data set, the 50 large cities, is 2 degrees Celsius, the differential, of course, being that half degree Celsius per century. And then the last two bars are a subset of this, and these are just the cities with the red dots. This is about 60% of the data, the cities in which we see an increase in the heat island over time. For those cities, we see the urban rate of warming is more than double the rural. And this was also found to be a statistically significant trend, an important one for these cities because they are warming rapidly and suggesting that they are likely to exceed the global forecast for warming over time and need to be prepared for that. I'll talk about that in a minute. other studies that have looked at changes in the urban heat island over time. They're not many, and this is not all of them, but these are some of the important ones that are most comparable to my study. The first is one by Jim Hansen, and again, he is responsible for the data set that I'm using. I'm using a subset of the larger data set that he has created at NASA and uses for his temperature anomaly observations annually. Measuring, this is not directly comparable, but this is showing the growth in the heat island. We can take this over time. This data set is looking from 1900 to 1999, so it's looking over a longer period of time. And we know those earlier decades in the 20th century, there was not as much warming as there was towards the end. And so by looking at that period of time, we would expect somewhat of a lower number. The Gallo et al. Study of about 2.26 degrees Celsius per century was not found to be statistically significant, but nonetheless I included, and it includes a much larger number of small cities. And so the reason this number is lower could be because it's including smaller cities, but then again it could be something else that I'm not seeing. The Calnay and Kai study is one I referenced before. It uses a very different methodology and finds the rate of warming in cities is amplification, as I'm characterizing it here, of about 0.35 degrees, and then my study of about half a degree per century. So again, my study is unique in that it's looking only at the largest U.S. cities and is different from each of these, but in terms of theory, it's not surprising to see that larger cities would not only generate larger heat islands, which have been found in other studies, I'm not saying that here, but that the rate of warming would be higher. So the findings, on average, the decadal rate of warming in large U.S. cities was about 30% greater than that of proximate rural areas, taken to represent background warming rates. For cities in which the heat island effect was enhanced during this period, that 60%, the decadal rate was about 150% greater than that of proximate rural areas. And that's a large number, suggests a significant increase in the rate of warming over time, which should be of concern. As warming scenarios developed by the IPCC are based on background global rates, again, it's largely a rural network, or it's one that's statistically modified the urban trends. The scenarios forecast are likely to significantly underestimate, particularly when we look at this subset of cities, the rate of warming. And so what's forecast here is an increase of 1.4 to 5.8 degrees Celsius by 2100. That, if these data are correct for not only these cities but global large cities, then that would suggest that large cities are going to be warming by more than this, and that we need to be preparing for that. Now, to give you an example, and this is dangerous territory, but I think it's useful to look at this. If we extend this trend forward, which is a simple linear extrapolation, it assumes that heat islands grow on average at the same rate they have historically, which there's no way to know if that's true. But if it is true, this is an interesting analysis, and it's just for the city of Atlanta. And it shows that we can choose somewhere in this range of 1.4 to 5.8 degrees Celsius for the IPCC projections for the planet as a whole, and what this shows is a 5 degrees towards the high end of that range, but this range continues to be kind of increased over time. So if we assume that over 100 years we're going to see about 5 degrees Celsius of warming, that'd be about 9 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the IPCC number. The question is, should we assume that number for places like Atlanta? If we look at the average city in this study, it would suggest an increase in that number of by a factor of 1.3, an increase of about 30%. Again, that's what I found over the last 50 years. So if we project that forward and assume an amplification of 30%, then we'd see an increase of about 12 degrees Fahrenheit in these cities. For the subset of cities that were found to be experiencing an increase in the intensity of the heat island over time, that would increase to a factor of about 2.5. So in this case, it would be about 23 degrees Fahrenheit, which is really an extraordinary number. And it illustrates the dangers of using a trend extrapolation, but also highlights something that is within the realm of possibility based on historical trends, and so that we need to be aware of. So in the case of Atlanta, if we took an average high for Atlanta, it would be about 89 degrees. And this were to occur, you'd be seeing temperatures in excess of 110 degrees for a high temperature in the summer. And that, obviously, were it to occur, would be a significant public health challenge. And there have been a handful of studies that have shown that this is within the realm of possibility if we are accounting for both background global warming phenomena and also the urban healing effect. It's important to note, of course, that we don't know moving forward what will happen. There are lots of theoretical negative feedbacks that could occur. There's data in the present period to suggest that heat islands induce rainfall. We see this in Atlanta. And so this could have a negative feedback on temperature change over time. There could be others as well that need to be highlighted. It's just uncertain. But one of the trends that we have a lot of confidence in as far as moving forward is that urban areas are going to grow rapidly. In this particular study by Nelson, this is my last slide, more than half of the built environment of the U.S. we will see in 2025 did not exist in 2000, giving planners an unprecedented opportunity to reshape the landscape. Cities are growing extremely rapidly right now. And this particular study suggests that the footprint of cities, the physical footprint, could double over 25 years, which is astounding. This likely foretells dramatic growth in the heat island and potentially amplification of what's happening as far as background warming. So in terms of planning, we need to be thinking about mitigating the drivers of global climate change, but also, of course, adapting to temperature changes that are underway, that are driven by global phenomena and are driven by local phenomena, driven by the heat island effect. And these results suggest that in large cities, that might be a tremendous challenge. And so I think I'm probably out of time, so I will conclude on that note and be thrilled to answer any questions.
Thanks, Brian. I know that there are two questions in the queue. And
I've just seen them, yes.
Do you want to read the question and give an answer?
I'll read it. I will read it here. First question, what are criteria used for rural stations? Are these stations within the metropolitan area but less urban than the urban stations? If so, why not use true rural stations, say those consistently at least 100 miles or so from the urban core? This may have popped up before I went to the slide, but the stations that are selected as rural, it's based on three criteria. One is that in terms of its night light, it is dark or dim in this case because there weren't enough dark stations, but that we know that with this particular data set there's reflected luminescence. And so in some areas that are perfectly rural, you may have reflected light that makes them appear dim. And I actually did some statistical testing to see if there were any differences between dark and dim stations, and there weren't. I'm looking at stations that have low population densities and that are within 50 to 250 kilometers. So in some cases this would get me to your threshold of 100 miles, but in many not. I don't want to move so far away that I'm dealing with a different regional climate. And so, and it's also the finding a sufficient number of stations that are going to be representative of the rural area in proximity to the urban area. So the 50 to 200 kilometers, 250 kilometers was, and the number changed during the course of the study as I was trying to find three independent rural stations for each urban station. And so I had to have a wide range to do that. But again, the goal is to get outside of the urban envelope such that there's no evidence based on the satellite data that you have urbanization occurring and that you have low population densities. But, you know, I'm sure if you wanted to put a threshold of 100 miles, that might create somewhat of a different outcome, but it would be challenging to identify a sufficient number of stations, I think. Does that answer your question? I don't know who asked it or whether you want to follow up, but I want to give you a chance.
Hi, Brian. Jim Yarbrough in EPA Region 6. Yeah, thanks for the
answer.
Just to follow up real quick.
Sure.
Could you also take into account, say, landforms that were there during certain times but maybe disappeared or for certain times? I'm thinking about reservoirs, for instance.
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is no. And the other issue with that is you may have military installations that have been decommissioned that could be influential. And so looking in terms of large reservoirs, we did look to see that we weren't positioned immediately on top of a large lake or some other kind of climatological influence, but smaller water bodies and things like military installations that may be hard to fully detect from the data we had, that could be a source of error. It could be a source of error. So it's a good question. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Let me move on to what I think is the next question here. How well do surface and air temperatures correlate? For example, you mentioned that surface temperatures at the airports tend to be lower than those in the CBD. Does this hold true for air temperatures? That's a great question. It depends on the conditions, depends on wind speeds, humidity, a lot of meteorological characteristics. There have been studies that have found, in terms of measuring the urban heat island effect, that there is a correlation for sure between surface and air temperatures, but it's an imperfect correlation. They tend to move in the same direction, but under certain conditions they can move in different directions. In general, in this case, I think it's safe to assume, it's quite likely, that you would have higher air temperatures, near surface air temperatures downtown, not only because you have a greater intensity of impervious cover, but also because you have radiation trapping that's happening in urban canyons that are found down between the buildings that are further intensifying warming. And so it's probably a safe assumption that airports are underestimating the temperatures we would see downtown. That may not be true under all circumstances, but I think it's a safe assumption. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. And then finally, did you look at mean temperature, or were you able to separate trends according to maximum and minimum temperatures? That's a great question. The mean temperature is derived from the average of the maximum and minimum, and that's the way the data sets are compiled. It's in that case, that's not probably the most accurate way to measure the mean temperature, but that's how it's compiled in these data sets. And we did not look at maximum and minimum independently. We just looked at the mean temperature for this study. Looking at minimum temperature would be probably a better way to capture the heat island effect per se. In all data sets, we didn't have available to us for all these weather stations the max and the min. In fact, and for the corrected data, the data that's most accessible to us, we wouldn't have had that for a number of stations. And so to be consistent, we use the same variable for all stations. That is, let me see, unless I'm, oh, one popped up or I missed it here. Looking at the airport infrared photo, I noted a fringe around the runways. I know this is asphalt and that it is hotter. Question, how much effect or improvement would occur if all urban surfaces were concrete? Wow, that's a great question. I'm sure there are folks on this call that are better qualified than I am to answer that question. I don't know. We know in general, if we're looking at new concrete and new asphalt, I might get in trouble, but I believe this is the case, that the concrete has a higher albedo. It's more reflective. Asphalt, as it ages, increases its albedo. I'm not sure whether it ever reaches the same level of reflectivity as concrete. And would love for somebody to pipe up who knows and tell me. But I think we would see a significant improvement on average if we were to change to concrete. That's not my area of expertise on the material. So I welcome somebody else to help me out.
This is Eva, and I guess I'll just interject that, as Brian was saying, concrete tends to darken over time, asphalt tends to lighten, and Lawrence mm-hmm. Berkeley Lab studies have shown that in about 5 years, they roughly converge around I don't know, maybe 0.25. I'm not sure of the exact albedo reading, but I think the thing to note is that there's a difference between surface temperatures and air temperatures. So while concrete may have a cooler surface temperature, there is this effect that you'll see with asphalt cooling off more quickly at night than where it was concrete. I don't know if it's due to its density or what the actual property is, the thermodynamic property, but it tends to more slowly release the heat. So it does, they have different dynamics at work, and I think, you know, we've been very careful about not just saying it's all albedo, because you really have to look at other properties like density and mm-hmm. So that's my two cents for that. I think we have time for one more question, and then I'd like to turn it over to Drew. So if someone didn't use the Q&A but wants to just verbally ask a question.
Can I jump in here?
Sure.
Sorry, it's Dietra from Sarasota County. Real quickly, are you noticing any trends? Because obviously for urban planners, we're looking at them and we're trying to decide what is the more prudent course, to have density and build vertically or to build horizontally. And
right.
And it seems as though with caverns and heat trapping, vertical construction has its
mm-hmm.
downfall. Are
mm-hmm.
you finding one being more useful than the other or more positive than the other?
Yeah, it's a great question, and to my mind, it's the one outstanding question that hasn't been addressed sufficiently in the realm of heat island research, and it's one for planning that's just absolutely critical. It depends, from my experience, it depends on how the question is asked, how we're measuring heat islands. I had a study a number of years ago that was looking at this particular question in terms of heat production within suburban and urban neighborhoods at the parcel level, which was suggesting that in terms of the total heat production in lower density environments on a per capita basis, it was higher. But of course, if we account for downtowns and the radiative trapping and things of that nature, it's hard to tease that out. But I think it's critical, and I wish there was a national pot of money. Let me get in my plug right now for anybody who has influence in these things. To fund a study to focus on measurement and to actually measure different urban areas in terms of their heat island characteristics. There have been a number of studies that have looked at kind of two-dimensional urban-rural temperature difference, but there are limitations to that approach to measuring. So in my opinion, there's not a clear answer to that question today, and it's critically, critically needed. So it's a great question, and I would welcome and invite others to weigh in who may have a different opinion on that.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, thanks a lot, Brian. We really appreciate it. And
my pleasure.
If people have additional questions, I'm sure they can just email you. Did you include your email, by the way, in your presentation?
I think it's on the first slide.
On the first slide?
Sure.
Okay,
is. Yep. Right.
Perfect.
There. Stone at Good Tech.
Okay. Thanks a lot. And maybe if you want to unlock control, and now we'll
okay.
turn it over to...
There we go.
Thank you so much. To Drew Crawley, who's a team leader at the Department of Energy. He's in the Commercial Buildings Research and Development Office. And Drew, are you able to?
I think I just got control.
Okay, great.
Here it comes. Okay. Hi, and thank you for having me today. What I'm presenting here is, and I'm sorry for the garbled byline there, but what I was trying to show was, although I work at the Department of Energy, this work is work that I've been doing for my PhD thesis at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. And what I've been trying to do is look at, my topic is using building simulation, single building scale simulation, to look at how it can be used in policy. And one of the things that has come up is, what is the impact on buildings? If you looked at some of the IPCC reports from 2000, 2001, that period, there was not a lot of information on it. It was all how buildings affected that, and there wasn't really any kind of the reverse, how buildings operation and energy use might be compounded and compounding the problem as we go forward. So that was part of what I was looking at. So I want to go through and show you some of the things I did to look in creating some artificial, but based on all of the measurements and the models that I could find, some weather files that I could use in doing some simulations and then looking at the impact. So that's what this is about. If we go into slide 2, just a reminder about the climate change scenarios that are in the IPCC. There were four major storylines here to represent different demographics, social, economic, and environmental developments. And some of it was things like business as usual, aggressive energy and environmental interventions, etc. So depending on that, you get different outcomes in terms of what the predictions of the models are. From that, there are four scenarios that, based on those storylines, that really represent the range of the climate impact from least to best, given the information at the time and the models. If we go on, then, of course, there were a number of global climate models, or GCMs, that were run, Hadley in the U.S. and CSIRO from Australia, and GCM and PCM from U.S., and I forget where the fourth one is. But to look at that. But if, back up. But the results, you've got 16 combinations of scenario and climate predictions on top of saying there. So when the IPCC comes together, there they sort of looks like this, where we have starting today a small change in 2001 up to changes, as Brian was mentioning, in that range of a degree and a half to 5.5 degrees C, quite wide. Of these, the Hadley, which is represented kind of the tallest bar down to about midway, HADCM3, has kind of the best spread of things. The PCM tended to be toward the bottom, and CSIRO was kind of a different spread and didn't have as good definition. If we go on, I also then want to look at kind of world climates, and Vladimir Köppen, who was a biologist looking at characterizing climate for agriculture, came up with a climate schema that, based on my experience in doing simulation and climate analysis over the years, really kind of fit my gut feeling of how things were working, and I'll show you there. But essentially, there's this category A to H, from tropical, hot, dry, mid, cold, and mid-dry, up to polar and even highland climates. And then you add in hot, cold, dry, wet, other combinations of that, and you get kind of 20 subcategories. If we apply that to the globe, you see that you actually get differentiation based on mountains and the local climates along the coast, so that we're getting some differentiation due to the marine climate. So it does fit what my experience was telling me with that data. If we move on to slide 6, what I wanted to do then was represent those climate scenarios using some of the existing data sets we had. The IPCC baseline period, it's the period that Brian was talking about as well. The best data set that we've got in the U.S. and even internationally does cover that period, 1961 to 1990. And then it's essentially the same as some existing typical weather files that we use in doing building energy analysis called TMY2. So there's a good match of the data sets coming from the same piece. So based on the scenarios, these global climate models will give us changes in the temperature and precipitation and cloud cover. From that, I can then extrapolate or take that information and modify my weather files. The Hadley data set actually had the best coverage. A lot of these were 2.5 degree or even 5 degree grids around the world, which is very coarse. But Hadley, through a couple steps of reanalysis, the Hadley Center had redone that and got a 1 degree grid around the globe. And they produced average monthly temperature changes as well as diurnal temperature changes and cloud cover, which I could then use to modify the existing files. Now, precipitation, yes, it's important in the climatological part, but for the most part, most of our simulation models, the building simulation models, don't take that into account today. There are a couple exceptions, but so I did not include that in this. In addition, I wanted to capture not just this typical piece or the typical files that we've been using, but also knowing that climate data varied throughout the period of record, I wanted to look at high and low cases as well. And I also wanted to look beyond just what business as usual or current energy standards were to where cases where energy efficiency was not in play or even part of the standard or even in considered, and then a low energy case, because that's one of the things we're working on. So I essentially created weather files for those scenarios to test the weather impacts. If I go on to the next slide, slide 7, so what does this make the climate change scenarios look like in an hourly data set? How do we apply that? We usually had an average monthly temperature change, and associated with that could be a daily or diurnal temperature change, where the amount of temperature between high and low was changing. And sometimes it was positive, but more likely it was a depression or a smaller change in the diurnal temperature. Often saw a decrease in cloud cover from the data, but it was usually pretty small from what I could tell, but it did mean some change in the solar radiation and some changes in precipitation, which varied quite a lot. If I take an example, this is a chart for one day. It happens to be Los Angeles from the typical weather file for November 23rd, and it had a nice pattern. If I take the yellow, that's the existing dry bulb temperature, and then the other bars represent the four ranges. Now, some of those are right on top of each other so that you can't see them because there was virtually no change between some of the scenarios, like I think A1 FI and A2 were in the same position, so you can't even see them. But here's what we're seeing is that we're starting off with a base diurnal temperature, and then we've got to change the temperature for the scenario, usually a smaller one. So there's a compression of that, and it seems to be affecting, from all the literature, it's looking at raising the nighttime temperatures significantly more, or more so than the daytime temperatures, that there seem to be some limits caused by the by humidity and other things that are helping to keep that high from going a lot higher. But we're still seeing a significant there. We're going from 21 to 25 degrees C here, and that's a big change for Los Angeles in November. In addition, we're seeing the nighttime temperatures remain higher and stay higher than that daytime temperature. If we move on, I did some work on the delta temperature as well. I did some work in looking at where measurements have been done for heat island and various things, including some of the work Brian had been doing, and found Eva's website and some others to really give me some background information. And all of it does say, you know, heat island's a function of city population, how intense it is, how extreme the temperatures are. The ranges appear to be about 1 to 5. I couldn't find any good numbers on that. I found one thesis from a PhD student in Houston who'd done extensive measurements in a number of locations in Houston who had gotten some pretty good temperatures, and they were kind of the middle range, 2.5 degrees. It seems to also be a function that once you get to a certain population density, the literature says roughly 5 degrees C, you're getting you hit kind of the high end of what the heat island is doing. It also depresses the daytime temperature, so we're seeing a little bit lower hourly daytime temperature while raising the nighttime temperature. Now, let me show you what that pattern looks like, and this is from all the pieces I've seen both in Europe and in the U.S. So here's an example of Dulles Airport here near Washington, the yellow line again being the existing dry bulb temperature, and then I've got two cases of a low case 1 degree change in the heat island effect, and the other being a 5 degree kind of the extreme. And what we see here is lower daytime temperatures, a small amount of daytime temperature reduction. But what you see in all the measured data is the nighttime, the temperatures remain higher, and it seems to be a case of about sunset, that the temperature just remains higher and floats lower slowly, that we're getting the radiation off the surfaces and out of the buildings after those hours, so the temperatures still remain higher. And those temperatures remain higher till about sunrise again. That's an approximation, but that seems to be where that information is. If we move on, I wanted to then take those files that I created, this new weather data, and test it out on a small building to see what the impacts would be. And it's a pretty typical building, about 3,800 square feet, two-story, pretty typical in terms of equipment and building fabric and everything else. And I simulated using our Energy Plus simulation program. And this is just a diagram of it to give you a feel. It's not an untypical suburban sort of little model. And I picked a small building because it was probably show more of the extremes with a larger building. If we go on to some of the results, here's taking the building in putting it at London Gatwick. And I had weather data for several of the data sets available in the U.S. I mentioned it was TMY2, but in other locations, there's an International Weather for Energy Calculations, or IWEC, and that's the first column in my chart. The rest of this is the source data for this, where this typical weather file came from, so simulating using actual weather throughout the entire data set. My thought here was that I ought to be able to pull the coolest and the warmest locations, and I would get the maximum and minimum temperature, or maximum and minimum energy. That would make sense. Unfortunately, that worked only, as you can see here, in London. If I do the same thing in Washington, if you look where the maxes and the mins are, they're not anywhere near the cool or the warmest years. But the good thing is that it seemed that the TMY2 was approximating about the mean energy impact for that particular building. But then what I wanted to do was to take that and sort the years. I want to find the year that had the minimum and the maximum, use those in my further analyses. So I had a minimum case, my typical case, and a maximum case for my our high, low, and middle. If I move on to... and see that about the midpoint of the years does work. In this case, if I go back, this data set at the time was 1961 to 2004, and because some of the new hourly data that's available, so I was able to have an extended period. So let me go on through that. So let's look quickly at the results. I've just got a few slides because I want to make sure Sarah's got some time here. But here's an example of looking at site energy being what you'd see at the utility meter. And the columns, the first three columns are dealing with the baseline case, the typical plus its high and low years from the previous slide. And then the next four set of bars are the four scenarios. And you see here in Washington, from a utility meter standpoint, we're actually seeing a decrease in energy. If you notice, though, the blue is going up. That's the cooling. But the red is decreasing a lot more. But that's not all the story. If we look at slide 15, if we look at source energy, the energy it takes to provide that energy, either at the utility plant or to get the natural gas to the building, it's kind of a different story. We're seeing that the cooling and the other parts of that are electricity are a much larger part of it, and the trend is almost flat here in Washington to the extreme case B2, where it's actually a small increase. If we look at other cases, I had a small version of the building that was a low energy case, making it the most efficient today and seeing what the impacts of that were. And what we found is that you see a lot less variation here on slide 16 than you would in some of the other cases. I still have a lot of data to analyze, but that kind of gives you a snapshot of how we can take these the macro studies such as the GCM or what Brian's done and apply them kind of at a local level of the weather files and to look at different buildings. So, Viva, I'll hand it back to you.
Thanks, Drew. And I'm sorry about the beeping sound. I think, could everyone please be sure to put your phones on mute by pressing *6 or using your mute button? I think you have one question already, it looks like, from AJ at USC.
Do I? Okay. I didn't.
But he didn't actually type in a question, or she.
I just wanted to ask the approach that Drew took in developing and simulating the model.
Yes.
What parameters did you consider?
For, you mean the building itself, or?
For the simulation.
For the simulation. I started with the information from the Commercial Building Energy Consumption Survey, which comes out of the Energy Information Administration, and it looked at the buildings, the small offices that were in the lowest quartile of that to see what the typical size and floors were. I then applied the ASHRAE standard 90.1, which were the which has the requirements for energy in the U.S. and used that to set the baseline for a lot of the other information. I compared it back to other studies that we've done, other real buildings, to make sure that that the building was reasonable in terms of energy consumption.
Thanks.
Are there other questions? Well, Drew, when do you expect to finish your research? Just curious for keeping an eye out for.
I'm expecting to finish this summer. I have all the analysis, or I have all the runs done at this point. But what I've done, I've got 25 locations throughout the world, large population centers, with these three different cases. So now it's just a matter of getting the data. So later this fall is my guess.
Okay, that's great. Well, thanks a lot. We appreciate it. And if people later on have follow-up questions, please feel free to email Drew. I hope that's okay, Drew,
sure.
For me to say that.
Sure.
And now for our last speaker, we have Sarah Espinoza. Sarah, I hope I'm saying your name right.
Yeah, that's right.
She has been on our call just a couple months ago to talk about a course that they're developing. And now it's been developed and it's online. So Sarah, do you want to go through it a little bit?
Yeah, and I'll actually be very brief. I just have a couple of slides. But as Eva mentioned, I'm with the National Environmental Education Foundation. And we have been working for several years now to create environmental education materials for broadcast meteorologists that are tied to weather reporting but sort of extend to other environmental science concepts. And as part of that effort, we have been working with an organization called the Cooperative Program for Operational Meteorology Education and Training, which is also known as COMET. They are part of the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research out in Boulder, to develop a series of short online environmental education courses that are tied to the weather. And what we found is that despite the fact that these were designed originally for TV meteorologists, they're really great resources and sort of topic primers for anyone who's interested. So I just wanted to quickly introduce the Weather in the Built Environment course, which we've just released about 2 months ago now, to this group as something that may be interesting to you or some of your constituencies. It's free, it's online, and it's highly interactive. It's really designed for busy professionals. So it's broken down into short units and even shorter lessons that you can walk away from and come back to as you would like. This second slide just outlines the main topics that are covered in this course. We go over past and current U.S. growth trends, sort of how have suburban and city areas changed and how are they projected to change in the future. And then the second two units of the course focus on how weather and the built environment relate. So the second unit really focuses on wet weather. How does increased pavement increase flooding in a city, and how might that impact local water quality? And then the third unit focuses in mostly on urban heat island effects and a little bit on air quality sources and conditions. The whole course takes about an hour to work through. All of the graphics that are in here are copyright cleared, so they're available for your use. And we're actually working on also putting these into podcasts, so that they could be downloaded to an iPod or into iTunes as well. So I'm happy to answer any content questions, but as I said, I just wanted to very briefly bring this to your attention. The link to access the course is on this last slide. It's free. You do have to register with Comet, but that is also free and really available to anyone who will find it useful.
Thanks, Sarah. Questions? Anyone? Well, I guess with that, we can maybe start with going around with any updates. To keep this kind of organized, I was thinking maybe if you have an update, you can just show through the feedback to presenter indicator, like maybe change your color from green to purple, as if you had a question, and then I'll call on you. But I know for an update, I was going to ask Jim Yarbrough from Region 6 to talk a little bit about their work doing, just to kind of kick off the update process.
Okay, Eva. Yeah, just very briefly, I think my colleagues, Kevin LeFave from the City of Dallas, and David Hitchcock from the Houston Advanced Research Center, and Holly Wilson from OAQPS are on, if I've got if I'm reading that correctly from the participants. So please chime in. But very briefly, the City of Dallas, the North Central Texas Council of Governments, and EPA are working together on something called the Dallas Sustainable Skylines Initiative. We have 7 projects that we're trying to complete within a 3-year period. One of those projects is focused on urban heat island and stormwater mitigation. And the Houston Advanced Research Center is under contract through EBA's office to provide really a look at the critical areas of urban heat island influence and impermeable pavements in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And based upon David's work at HARC, which is going to be finished, I understand, pretty soon, the initiative is going to sponsor a rollout to the private sector, really with 3 foci. One, reforestation to address some regional aspects of the heat island, and then number 2 and 3, reflective roofs and reflective pavements. And along those lines, we've been really fortunate that the Texas Trees Foundation has really stepped up to work with the City of Dallas, in as well as the Urban Forestry Advisory Council to the City of Dallas, to help sponsor a very interesting one-day event that's going to sort of accompany David's report rollout. And I guess, David, that's supposed to be in June at this point.
We hope so.
Yeah.
Need it to be a lot hotter than it is here right now, though.
Right. And then we'll have similar rollouts to focus on reflective roofs and reflective pavements. And regarding pavements, we've been encouraged that several local industries and industry associations have stepped up and have indicated that they would like to take part in this rollout and perhaps later on in the year sponsor a seminar to talk about all different kinds of cool pavement options for the Dallas area. So anyway, that's taking off, and we're encouraged that the private sector is responding.
Thanks, Jim. Does anyone have questions for Jim?
Yeah, Jim, it's Demetra again. Sorry to jump in there, Ava. Because you've connected the urban heat island to stormwater mitigation, is it right to assume that the reflective pavements are all or some pervious?
Yeah, in fact, we are looking at cool permeable pavements. And so far, the industries that have indicated an interest are representing different products, but very permeable concrete pavements are one option. Even grass pavers are another that may be featured at the seminar later in the year. So we're not just focusing on one, but I think we're looking at various options that can be presented to the private sector to look at cost as well, because as has been explained in Texas, we don't have necessarily the demand yet to force down the cost for some of these alternative pavements, as might be the case in California.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Actually, I was going to ask someone from Dallas, or maybe David, who could you talk a little bit about the building code and cool roofs? I didn't have a chance to read through the recent adoption, but just even a line or two about what's going on there.
Okay, there are a couple of building code changes. Well, there are a lot of building code changes going on in both the City of Dallas and the City of Houston. The City of Dallas, not just the cool roof provisions that are in there, but the Dallas code is incorporating a lot of LEED related standards, and LEED contains not only references to roofing, but also to other development characteristics that include heat island mitigation. The Houston code has been changed to specifically incorporate cool roofs, and there's a series of other changes that are being reviewed tonight in a meeting with the city's code committee.
So have those already been adopted? And
the cool roof?
Yeah.
The cool roof change has been adopted. The first phase in Dallas, their green building ordinance changes have been adopted as well.
Okay, great.
Hi, this is Kevin from the City of Dallas. David's right. We about 2 or 3 weeks ago, our City Council and Mayor approved the green building ordinance, and it'll be a two-phase project. But basically, everything that will be built in the City of Dallas. The first phase goes in 2009, the second phase 2012, and after that point everything built will have to meet certain green standards. And that's not just city or municipal buildings, it's also residential, commercial, remodels, everything.
Oh, wow. that's huge, yeah.
Yes.
Can I ask, but it's not requiring cool roofs. It's using that as an option to comply. Is that
right? It's more of a menu to where developers or people, you know, doing remodels can choose from a punch list of options. You know, meeting a certain amount of points in different areas, energy consumption, water usage, things like that, landscape, et cetera, to you have to get a certain amount of points in order to, it's kind of based on the LEED. And it basically it comes down to it needs to be certifiable.
Okay.
But it's not hard and fast, because obviously you can't, you know, some people don't have as many resources as others, so they can't, you know, dictate directly what they have to have. It's just they've given them multiple options from each area, and they have to pick, you know, two or three in order to hit a certain amount of points for each area.
Okay, great. And will you have any grant? Will the city be like providing any grants or any kind of technical assistance or to help people comply with the code changes?
At this point, I could not answer that question accurately. I don't believe we are, but I can certainly try and find out a little bit more clear of an answer.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
That's helpful. It's good news. I don't see any people indicating that they have an update. So I guess we will be coming to a close. I want to tell everyone who's on the phone that this will be my last webcast. I'm very sorry to say that. I'm going to be leaving the EPA this summer to move to Uganda, because my husband has received a new position there with the World Bank. He's an environmental specialist as well. So we'll be moving over there for about 3 years, and I do hope that this program will continue, and we're working on finding a replacement. So I am not actually going to, you know, leave until towards the end of June. So I do hope that you'll send me recommendations for webcast topics you continue to like to hear about, so that I have some material to hand over to this next person to keep this program going. I also want to note, I know we said that the Urban Heat Island Compendium would be up soon, and it is pretty much, you know, a couple of the chapters are already done, but we thought it made the most sense to actually post it when we post the revamped website. And that's taking a bit longer to actually change all the web pages, and even in the revised
webcast call page, I noticed that there were some errors, so I apologize for that. And it's just, it's a whole process, so we're continuing to evolve that and fix that. But the webcast page, which now posts the PowerPoints and the recordings and kind of organizes the presentations by topic, which I thought would be a lot more helpful and useful than by the date that the webcast or conference call was given, that will be, as I was saying, kind of tweaked and refined a bit more. But always open to suggestions if you, you know, have any. So I do see one purple indicator light. So Art, do you want to provide an update of some sort?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, Eva. I'm sorry to hear that you're moving on, but congratulations and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Yes, I wanted to provide an update. The city of Chamblee, Georgia, which is on the northeast side of Atlanta, became the first city in Georgia to adopt a LEED-based green building requirement for private developments as well as public developments. That will take place, or that will take effect April 1st, 2009. So they decided to include a little more flexibility and allow a Green Globes certification or a LEED basic level certification. But one or the other will be required for private developments over 20,000 square feet, as well as all future city projects.
Art, can I ask, is that for commercial buildings, or is it also, does that also apply to residential?
Well, it applies to residential, multifamily, and mixed use, and commercial, but it's just a size threshold. So anything meeting that size threshold will have to be LEED certified. Of course, you could build a smaller apartment complex, you know, 5 units or whatever, and you wouldn't have to meet that requirement.
Okay. Oh, that's great.
It's a start. We're starting to get some favorable publicity as well as some inquiries from developer organizations and contractors who want to learn more about LEED and what they'll have to do. And the state of Georgia Department of Community Affairs is beginning to participate more in discussions about how LEED and LEED principles could be incorporated into building codes and model ordinances and so forth. So it's a slow process.
But it's in the right direction. So
yeah.
that's great.
Yeah.
I see that Jeff King has
same lines here in the D.C. region. The Council of Governments, which represents a lot of the local jurisdictions in the region and the Intergovernmental Green Building group that we have here, endorsed adopting LEED for at least government buildings, and we've already seen a couple of our counties starting to take action. I think Loudoun County and Montgomery County have each put in some changes to their code that include requirements for LEED, and so that's something that's happened in the last couple of months.
That's great.
The only other thing I can say is we also just had a meeting in our SIP, on our 8-hour ozone SIP. We did have a tree canopy heat island component, which committed us to pulling together a group to start a kind of a canopy management initiative. And that we held our first meeting in the last month or so. And on a parallel track, we have our climate change steering committee also thinking about land use and the tree canopy. I think in the case of the foresters, there is some discussion of trying to promote a 5% increase in canopy, which is a long way from where we are now. The Climate Change Steering Committee is a little less aggressive, and they're shooting for a no net loss. But we'll see how all that plays out.
And Jeff, can I just clarify, you guys, what kind of tree inventory data do you have? Have you done a recent analysis so that you can track that 5%?
Well, I think that was part of the effort of the first a meeting was to kind of sit around the table with the foresters from Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, as well as some other stakeholders in the U.S. Forest Service to kind of come up with, so, you know, what data sets do we have, what do we need, where are we going to get it. The District of Columbia actually has a pretty robust database. I think they pretty much have inventoried all the street trees in the city. But at this point, I don't think we really have a good handle on the total canopy, and that's part of the discussion with this work group is to get a sense of where we need to take it.
Okay, great.
Hey, Jeff, did you say you're taking SIP credit for the urban canopy changes?
No, not yet. No, it's in our SIP as a voluntary measure. No SIP credit at this point, you know, given where we're at. But
okay.
I don't know. Yeah, Kevin, do you still
yeah.
do? You, okay, go ahead.
I wanted to follow up. I've got an answer already. I emailed one of the leads on our green building project, and she said that the task force actually will have a group of members that will be working specifically on incentives and grants.
Oh, great.
And currently our housing department has a program in place for affordable housing, and that we're also planning to request grants from a couple different enterprises. So our intent is to have assistance during phase one of the program. So I was incorrect in my original assessment. And as far as guidance and training, our Office of Environmental Quality, they're looking to try and incorporate a green office as one of our functions at the Office of Environmental Quality to develop a training program for developers and builders.
Wow. Well, that'll be...
We've got a little bit of time before that goes, but it'll definitely be interesting to see.
Well, that'll be good to keep on, you know, kind of keep tabs on, and I'm sure it's a lesson learned or, you know, a good peer exchange type presentation in the future. So.
Yes.
Well, thank you, everyone. And again, I want to encourage you to please, you know, email me webcast topics that you'd be interested in hearing about in the future, and I'll send forwarding information before I leave. So hopefully we'll keep in contact with some of you. So thank you, and bye-bye.
Hey, Eva.
Bye, yeah. Eva. Good luck with everyone.